I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode number 146 of the Ridge Hunter Outdoors podcast. This week, we got our first Canadian guest on the show. His name is Martin Brose. He's the author of the book Brown Gold, A Guide to Shed Hunting in North America. So obviously, we talked to him about shed hunting. We talked to him about some of the Canadian lifestyle. I thought that was interesting since we had somebody on from out of the country. Might as well talk to him about that. We joked in the podcast that not only is he our first Canadian guest, but he's our first international guest, if you want to look at it that way. So we had a lot of fun talking about that kind of stuff. Talked about his background in hunting and everything and how he got to where he is writing books about shed hunting. We got some stories from him on some of his favorite sheds that he's found, stuff like that. So I think you guys are going to enjoy the conversation. You should go check out his book. You can get it on Amazon, and we're also going to be giving away a copy of the book. If you want in on a chance to win the book, just send us a message either through our Facebook, our Instagram, or our website, or you can comment wherever you're listening to this. So if you're on YouTube, leave a comment. Brose book. So it's B-R-O-S-E book. Just leave that comment. Like I said, if you're on YouTube, you can comment that on our social post, or you can send that message to us directly. Brose book, and that will get you entered for a chance to win a free copy of Brown Gold, A Guide to Shed Hunting in North America. If you want to know what's in the book, we talk about that a little bit too. So stick around for the episode number 146. This is the Ridge Hunter Outdoors Podcast. Okay, so we got Martin on the line here. We're going to talk about kind of his background, get you guys a little bit of where he came from, his upbringing and all that, and then we're going to get into his book that I mentioned in the intro. But first, Martin, how's it going, man? And it's nice to meet you.
Oh.
Officially.
Yeah, nice to meet you guys. Glad we could finally connect on here.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't mention when we were talking there before, I got my co-host Nate is with me, so you get to hear from him occasionally.
Hey, Martin.
Absolutely. He chimes in every so often, eh?
Yeah.
Yes.
He's here for moral support as much as anything.
Moral support, non-witty marks, remarks. Just a time filler.
Oh, that's good. Well, you got to have someone to bring some logic and witty remarks into the conversation.
For sure.
That is not me.
I don't know if you're familiar with the Howard Stern show, but like Beetlejuice off of there. That's kind of Nate. So, yeah, man, how you doing? And I think you're calling from a little ways away, correct?
Yeah, I'm up in Alberta, just kind of, we would call it central Alberta, but if you actually looked on a map, I'm pretty far south, pretty far east in a little town called Drumheller.
Okay.
Just kind of just off a big river valley, and you get kind of the Badlands is kind of where I reside, I guess.
Okay. I could not point to that on a map, so you have to excuse my American ignorance on Canadian geography, but I kind of know about where you're at.
That's okay. Basically find the mountains and go to the east of it, and you know, I'm about an hour and a half away from Calgary would be the biggest
okay.
town.
Yep. I do watch some hockey, so I know about where Calgary's at.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, go Flames.
We're down about an hour and a half from St. Louis, so 2019 was a good year for us.
Absolutely, yeah.
Other than that, it's been a little bit tough, but Nate's showing me where you're at on a map, so I got you now.
Oh, yeah.
Just a hair east of the mountains there, huh?
More than a hair, but yeah. I think I got to drive for maybe 30 minutes and get up on the tallest hill, and I can start seeing the mountains. So
right.
It's a nice area.
You're straight east of Banff.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Our audience will be familiar with that.
Some, maybe.
cool. So What do you, we'll get into, I was going to ask what kind of hunt you guys do up there, but we'll get into that. So first thing we always ask new guests and we kind of start with is, obviously you do some hunting. So I want to know who got you started on hunting and what you started hunting and where that all took place.
Yeah. So my background hunting, like I didn't grow up hunting at all. You know, my dad was not a hunter, but fortunately for me, my grandpa was a hunter. So I remember as a kid, just kind of going out and, you know, every so often he'd have me over and they'd be cutting up a deer in the garage. And for me, that just kind of was, you know, I hung out and they did cutting up the deer. I remember very distinctly one time taking a deer and just being like, oh, geez, let's hit those with a hammer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so like literally didn't really have much of a background into it. When I was in my 20s, I was working way up in northern Alberta and the fire chief was a big hunter. And at the same time, my grandpa kind of said like, hey, if you get your gun license, like, I will give you a shotgun for free. And this is kind of in the time of The Walking Dead and everything like that. And so I was like, ooh, that'd be super cool for like a zombie defense kind of thing. Completely not thinking about hunting at all.
Right.
But ended up getting my gun license and the fire chief in northern Alberta kind of took us out. It mostly just involved driving around a bunch of lease roads and just through the bush. And, you know, a pack of wolves had kind of gone through where we were hunting. So we really didn't see too many deer or anything like that. But that was basically my introduction. And first thing I ever ended up shooting was just like a prairie chicken. A little grouch, and I was so proud of it, so happy, and it probably one of the best meals I ever tasted.
Heck yeah. That's apocalypse, way more practical use for a shotgun than hunting, of course.
Way more, yeah, it's something that you use it every day.
Absolutely.
I use my shotgun for killing zombies constantly.
Yep.
But yeah, it was a very interesting kind of introduction to it, because I really didn't expect to get into hunting, and I didn't really have that background. Like, I grew up in the city, just not, you know, hunting and camping wasn't really a big thing to me. Like, most people would go to Jasper or Banff and just kind of hang out in the mountains. And, you know, you might do a hike here and there. And that was about as outdoorsy as most people get when they're from the city. So, kind of got into it completely by accident, but wouldn't change a thing.
Cool. Yeah. We've had several people on who, kind of a little bit later onset when it comes to hunting stuff. And actually a guy we just talked to on the last episode, similar story, like he lived in a bunch of big cities, never had a lot of opportunity and finally got into it. I mean, he kind of grew up hunting birds and stuff, but never got into big game hunting until later in life. So when did you finally harvest your first big game animal? And was that a deer or was it something else?
Yeah, it was the next season. So I started hunting, you know, got everything all set up, shot one bird, and then the next season managed to get a doe. And then, you know, you'd get kind of connected to some of these hunters, and I started looking at the wall and just being like, wow, like I struggled so hard to shoot a doe, and you know, all these people have these crazy deer on the wall and stuff like that. And I really like that, like aesthetically, right? Like, I was like, that's, it just looks so cool to me. So that's how I ended up getting into shed hunting, is because I was kind of looking around being like, well, like, how else can I get antlers on the wall?
Yeah.
And someone was like, well, you can pick up some sheds, I guess. And it's like, oh, yeah, sure. How do I do that? And, you know, the advice I got was just start walking and you'll find them eventually. And I think I spent quite a few months just walking around on my way up to northern Alberta and just not finding anything at all. There's a lot more to it, I think, than just walking around, I think.
For sure, for sure. We've had some guys on in the past, too, that have been way more successful at it than I have, and they've given us some good advice, and I've used that advice to find a few more. But there's something to be said for guys who can do it consistently, like knowing where to look and where to find them. And I can honestly sometimes walk right over the top of them and not even see them. So there, you got to have an eye for that kind of thing, too, especially like where we're at, and I'm sure it's probably the same for you in places, those antlers can blend in super well with some of the terrain.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you kind of get that eagle eye for it eventually. I think that's something that just gets developed as you start finding more and more. And obviously, I spend a ton of time out doing it, and there's still been times where I've been out shed hunting with people, and they're like, did you mean to walk past this antler? And it sometimes can just be the difference of, you know, you're looking left and the antler's on the right.
That's when you say, yeah, I didn't want that one.
Yeah. Oh, it's no big deal.
Right. Right.
So absolutely.
I do want to back up a little bit because obviously you kind of got into hunting a little later. So we jumped all the way into your 20s. But did you grow up in Canada? You've been there all your life?
Yeah, I grew up just in Edmonton. So that's almost smack in the middle of the province.
Mm-hmm. So you're not an Oilers fan. You're a Flames
no,
fan,
I'm,
though?
No, I'm actually a Red Wings fan of all the places that I could be from. I know. Don't ask me about the last couple of years. It's been rough.
Yeah. Well, the blood's not as bad as it used to be with the Blues, so I guess I can accept it. At least you didn't say Blackhawks.
Yeah, there's some good fights thrown up. I remember that being quite the rivalry as a kid, watching a lot of bloody players going off and playing St. Louis.
Back in the good old days of hockey.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that's so.
Yeah,
did you play growing up?
The Red Wings, that's for sure.
Right? Did you play growing up?
Like rec league hockey. Yeah, 100%. I played a little bit of hockey.
That's basically part of the culture up there, right? Like you play hockey and drink beer.
Yeah, a lot of people. If you're not playing hockey, you at least watch hockey,
right?
And you know, you have to have some kind of a cursory knowledge of hockey in general. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's. I mean, there's pockets of it here for sure, especially if you're around a place that has a team, but there's definitely places where like there's zero opportunity to play it or even be around it. So it's really interesting. I guess it'd be kind of like probably like baseball up there. Like there's probably not a lot of baseball being played in Canada in parts, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, our baseball opportunity is definitely limited. Like there's no high school teams or anything like that. Like the most we really get is, you know, we'll play a fair bit of softball in the summer, but like slow pitch. But, you know, actual competitive baseball is very minimal for
right,
sure.
Right. So
I had always heard if you were not in good enough shape to play hockey, you had to be a curler in Canada.
Like, I haven't heard that one, but it would make sense. Yeah.
Like, for instance,
I think that's one of my favorite things about. Like curling is really funny to watch in the Olympics because these guys are competing at, you know, they're at Olympic level competition and then they go back home and they're like an insurance salesman.
So yes. Like, for instance, Canyon would be a hockey player and I would be a curler is how that would be down here.
Okay. Fair enough.
They definitely look like beer league guys. No doubt. That's an interesting one, but Olympic athletes, you got to give them that.
Yeah. They clearly have got some skill, and yeah, it's just like the bond spiels and stuff like that you get are interesting because you'll get just some random person, and then you're playing next to you know, fairly competitive players.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot easier to get into extremely competitive curling, I would say, versus extremely competitive hockey.
Interesting, just less opportunity, I guess. That's kind of interesting. We'll get into the hunting and shed hunting stuff for sure, but like the differences in the culture between Canada and America, even though we're like literally neighbors, and obviously geography has a lot to do with that, and weather for sure,
climate,
like what you're talking about, because you can go again, like just go to Mexico, and then the drastic difference between America and Mexico, even more from Mexico to Canada, because like there's some parts of Southwest America that are basically Mexico. So, and I get, I'd assume there are probably parts of like North Central America that are basically Canada. So, it's interesting to me to talk to somebody from up where you're at. What was it like as a kid kind of growing up there? I mean, obviously we're probably defined more by our similarities than differences, but I'm sure there were some differences.
Yeah. It's a very seasonal area, right? Like you get the very four distinct seasons, so that's kind of nice. I think our seasons are kind of a little bit more offset. Our winter is definitely longer. You know, it kind of stretches out. You can go out places even in like May, June, and there's still snow kicking around in the mountains and a fair bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, growing up was it was excellent. Like I no complaints growing up out here. I wouldn't change it for anything.
Mm-hmm.
It is nice because you can kind of have those different four seasons to do different things and focus on different things. And I think that's played honestly quite a lot into to hunting for me.
Mm-hmm. So,
and talking about hunting, do you have whitetails and muleys both there?
Yeah. Oh, Alberta, okay. It's a fantastic area for hunting because we have just such a wide variety of big game species, right? We have like bighorn sheep, moose, elk, whitetails, mule deer, like cougars, bears. It's pretty diverse, the things that you're able to hunt in this area, even some bison up north.
Wow.
So what elevation are you at? Are you still fairly high above sea level, or are you far enough from the mountains that you're getting down pretty low?
We're fairly low. One of the areas that's quite close to where I'm living is called the Hand Hills, and there, I believe they hold the furthest or the highest place west of the Rockies until you get...
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Somewhere in like Ontario or something like that. So there's a big, big jut up off the prairies where it's very, very flat, and then all of a sudden there's these hand hills, and they're mm-hmm. very tall.
Okay.
But yeah, overall we're getting down in elevation. We're not anywhere like Colorado or anything like that.
Right, for sure. So where are you guys finding most of the whitetails at up there? Are they kind of a mixture of up in the higher stuff? Are they down in the prairies? What's kind of the timber makeup like there? Is there any ag in your area?
Yeah, there's tons of ag. Okay. Drum Hollow kind of sits on this, almost like a border. To the north of us, you kind of get into some really rolling hills and lots of bush country and stuff like that. And kind of the further north you go, the thicker the bush gets and the more prevalent it is. And then you get up into where there's almost purely just bush and muskeg.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of to the east of us is about where you get into the really, really flat, flat prairie land. There's a fair bit of ag in there. There's lots of, that's kind of typically more mule deer country, mm-hmm. but there is whitetails mixed in. And then, yeah, obviously going west, it's kind of still agriculture land and then ranch land, and then you get to the Rockies.
Okay. What are
so
they growing?
A huge mix of terrain that I can go and shed hunt and hunt in, that's
nice.
For sure.
Nice. What are they growing up there typically, as far as the ag goes?
Yeah, it's canola. Definitely mm-hmm. lots of canola and lots of wheat would be the two main things.
Cool. Which do you see the deer prefer? Which do you find most of your sheds in, or is it about 50-50?
Most times, like canola is more of a fall time, summertime thing that they frequent. They like to hide out in that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very great food-wise unless you get something seeded underneath.
Mm-hmm.
So most times you'll find them in the other crops, especially if there's been anything left standing.
Mm-hmm.
I typically find that if I'm going to look for, you know, a field to get permission in or anything like that, I'll cruise around and try and find where they have alfalfa. That seems to be the number one draw out there for sure.
Yep. That's what I was going to ask, if there was any of that up there too, because we'll see that a lot here. Even our deer in the Midwestern United States are, alfalfa is a big draw. Even winter wheat, like you're talking about, you'll see, start to see sheds, and they're, I mean, they shine like a diamond in a goat's butt in the wheat field. So like you can see the antlers out there pretty good, but a lot of times the deer will get out there, and that's what's left a lot here too. So like once the winter rolls around, of course, all the regular crops are out, all the natural browse starts to die, unless you've got big food plots or something, or you've left them some standing beans. A lot of their feeding is going to be done in either cut corn fields where there's some left over, or those winter wheat fields. So that's a lot of places where we'll start to see our first sheds, seems like.
Yeah, that's usually where I'm looking for early season stuff. Like I don't like to go in and push deer through the bush or anything like that. So if I'm going early season, you know, I always get that itch around January, February, where it's just like, okay, like the season's coming up, let's go, let's find something.
Mm-hmm.
I try and stay out of the bush because I just don't want to, you know, pressure deer or anything like that, and you don't want to bump them, you know, the next county over.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I try and focus on mostly those food plot areas, which can be very tricky. Like some of these areas, you know, it's one or two fields that they're hitting, or they're just, you know, if you go up north where there's just bush, the deer are not as concentrated, right? Those food sources mm-hmm. are very sparse, and you know, they're just eating a little bit of leaves here, grass here, mm-hmm. and then moving on. So finding some of those food sources, that's definitely a huge key for just hunting and shed hunting.
Yeah. As the deer's kind of cycle of life the similar up there where, so like for us, usually August into September, like mid-September, late August into mid-September, most of the bucks will be shed from their velvet. Of course, October rolls around. They're still kind of in an early season pattern. As we get to like the third week of October, you start to see some pre-rut. The best, like the first rutting activity, first part of November, I say our peak rut where we're at is probably like 17th to 19th, where if you get a little bit farther north than us, is maybe the 15th. Is, of course, if you go south, it's going to be later than that. But then you kind of hit, obviously, everything after that. Is that similar where you're at, or is it shifted a little bit as far as when the deer are doing what they're doing? Our partners at Flambeau Outdoors have some of the best solutions in the industry for your decoy and storage needs. They're focused on innovation that matters, and they build their products to last. They're probably most known for their whitetail, waterfowl, and turkey decoys, and that's for good reason. They've got a lot of quality options at great price points in each category. The Boss Buck is a personal favorite of mine in their whitetail line, and I've been throwing their Stormfront mallards in front of duck blinds for years now. Don't sleep on their storage solutions either, though. Whether it's fishing tackle, firearms, ammo, or archery equipment, they've got you covered. They just stepped up their archery storage game, too, with the new Formula Bow Case. It might just be the best bow case on the market. We've been using ours for several months now, and I'm continually impressed with the ease of use and security they provide. Make the most of your time outdoors with Flambeau. Realism that gets results.
I would say it would 100% depend on the hunter you're talking to and kind of the area. Like some people are, you know, posting in the Facebook groups here early, you know, November 1st being like, oh, the rut's in full swing, boys, let's go.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say overall your calendar kind of sounds a bit similar. Yeah, maybe shifted by, you know, 5-10 days, not very much of a sideways shift that way. There's, yeah, definitely like that October lull I find where the deer just disappear and you have to kind of refine them or just change up your tactics.
Mm-hmm.
Usually we get the opportunity, you can hunt them in velvet a little bit, like just very, very early season, early September.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of seasons up north that are open like August, end of August. So there is opportunity to get some nice whitetails in velvet.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, the majority of our hunting season just kind of lands right after they shed.
Yep, ours is the same way. That was going to be my next question, if you guys had any chance to hunt them in velvet. There are places, Kentucky, for example, opens really early in September, so there's a lot of velvet bucks that get killed there every year. I believe maybe Tennessee, South Carolina maybe has the earliest season.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some opportunity here. Missouri opens like September 15th, right around there every year. So like you're saying, you could get... If one's holding velvet late, you would have a chance there. But most of the time, we just don't see it, unless, of course, they have an injury or something. I was curious.
Yeah, we're able to get after them. Yeah, we're able to get after them. You know, maybe you get about a week or two where they're in velvet. I definitely know the opener around us, we usually are hunting mule deer in velvet for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, like a lot of people, their perspective on Canada is huge bodied whitetails, of course, big racks too. But what are you seeing for average weight? Oh, not only the whitetails, but I'd be curious on the muleys too. Average body weight, like on the hoof, if you had to say, we're in your area.
Oh man, I wouldn't know. I know that, you know, it is a noticeable difference. Even the Northern Alberta bucks tend to be a little bit bigger bodied than some of the ones running around here in the South. Our body size is definitely what, like, obviously it's well known. It's kind of like that Alberta Saskatchewan is just known for body size.
Mm-hmm.
Our mule deer tend to be a little bit bigger than our whitetail. So you can get some very heavy, big bodied, mule deer that you then have to pack out of a river valley.
Right. They're always going to die in the bottom too.
Yeah. You shoot at them and they just go straight down.
For sure. For sure. So, yeah, obviously a lot of people think of that. They think of the bigger bodied deer. I do want to go back a little bit here to you though. After high school, I guess you said you started hunting in your 20s. So like, did you go to university or anything like that?
No, I actually just went straight from high school and became a paramedic.
Okay, cool.
That's my career outside of writing books and shed hunting.
That's the other thing I was going to ask. You mentioned the fire chief earlier, so I assume you're on a fire department, or were?
No, it was just meeting him through EMS calls, actually.
Oh, okay. So the lovely world of EMS led you to him.
Absolutely, yeah. I will. Big credit to Terry for taking me out. 100%.
Nice. We're actually both firefighter EMTs, so we got a little bit of. Well, we know what you're talking about when you talk about a lot of stuff. If you talk about EMS, it's definitely an interesting world.
Yeah, no, a lot of hunters out here, or a lot of paramedics out here, a lot of them end up getting into hunting. I think it's because it's kind of that extreme adrenaline junkie kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Where I work, I would say over 50% of the station where I work, the guys all hunt.
Yeah, I very would good. Think it'd be a good stress relief too, because, you know, not to say you'd ever want to shoot your patients, but you can go get some of that out on some wildlife potentially.
Yeah, I think, and it's, you know, you get that chance to just get out and even just relax and be mindful, that kind of stuff too. Is attractive to paramedics.
What kind of a population you have there around where you're running?
It looks big.
Like Drumheller specifically?
Yes.
Yeah.
We're about 8 to 10,000 people. It's a very big, like, summertime town. It's a big tourist town. There's a big dinosaur museum. There's lots of fossils out here. So
I have been looking at pictures of the dinosaur.
Yeah, Tyra the Tyrannosaurus Rex. That's one of the biggest things we're famous for. You can go walk up inside her and look out over the valley.
Wow.
I guess.
Wow.
So
we're famous for dinosaurs, that's for sure. The whole town is dinosaur themed.
Nice. So you definitely have enough population to keep you busy, and then it sounds like at any given time there could be considerably more people in the area. So, like, there's a town close to us. I think population, at least on the signs, like 15 or 16,000, but they say at any given time there could be 100,000 people in town right there. So I would say, especially during the summer months, sounds like you're probably very similar to where your population is not really a direct reflection of your potential call volume.
Oh, yeah. That's our call volume drops off big time in the winter because, you know, no one really wants to go out running around the Badlands when it's minus 30 out.
Mm-hmm. I would do the BS calls go down in the winter as well?
A little bit, yeah. I don't know if it's just the winter or what happened, but I find that our call volume 100% drops. And, overall, I think it's just everything kind of decreases. Yeah. I don't know if it's just they all decrease at the same rate or if it's, significant one way or another.
Mm, okay. So you obviously had to do some kind of schooling for that. How long was the program to get into that?
So our program was, there's EMR, emergency medical responder, which is kind of the very basic, like, way to work on an ambulance. They're not super common out here, but there is a couple. That's anywhere from a 2-week course, very intense 2-week course, or, you know, 3 to 6 months, I believe, is kind of the average course length. And then, to get your primary care paramedic is a year approximately. Okay. And then, past that is 2 years for advanced care paramedic, and that's kind of the top. There is, you know, flights and stuff like that. We'll talk about critical care paramedicine. It's not like a recognized designation in Alberta, but that's kind of where you get into a different set of protocols.
Yeah, that's somewhat similar to us where we have, so EMR would be like your basic first responder is they can't really do much. They can take vitals, stuff like that. I'm not sure. Depending on the system you're in, you may be able to give certain medications and stuff. Then you go up to like the EMT level, and there's EMT basic, intermediate, and then you get to your paramedic. And I think the paramedic is 18 months. Is it 24?
I think it differs on who you take it from.
Yeah. Okay. So it sounds fairly
similar. The schooling is very, it depends on, which school you take. There's some that do like the distance, and that usually tends to stretch it out a little bit further. And then there's some that are like a very intense, very quick course.
Okay. Yeah. So you're doing paramedic stuff, and you're starting to get into hunting. What made you want to start riding?
That's a good question. As I'm out there kind of walking around, I've always thought, you know, like, how would I tell the story? Or, you know, thinking back on some of these adventures and misadventures I've had, like, how would I, you know, tell that to people? And then I've taken people out quite a lot, and they always say, like, wow, you know so much. Like, how did you figure that out? Or like, how do you know all this stuff? And just as I've been walking around, usually in my head I'm just kind of thinking like, well, how would I explain some of this stuff to people, you know, to pass it on to future generations, or you know, if I'm trying to get a new person into shed hunting, you know, like what lessons would I teach them? So, at one point I just started kind of writing stuff down and, you know, and then there's the whole like organizing the chapters and organizing your ideas. And it just kind of all like slowly came together over a couple of years, just kind of plugging away at it. So, one of my big inspirations was definitely Steve Rinella. His writing is always, just so, engaging. So I tried to imitate that as much as I could, where he's kind of teaching and then, you know, adding in little stories here and there to help, explain it.
Yeah, for sure. It helps with engagement too, no doubt. So Brown Gold is your book, A Guide to Shed Hunting in North America. So let's get into that a little bit. Give me the wave tops of the book. You don't have to get too in-depth, but we'll start from there and then maybe we'll dive into it a little bit more. But just kind of like a 30,000-foot view.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Of what people are going to find in the book.
Yeah, so the book is, you know, I tried to kind of write it as a little bit of like a how-to, a little bit of my own personal experiences, and then also like a storybook. So it's got kind of, like if you were a brand new shed hunter and were like, how do I do this? It's got a lot of information about like, what is shed hunting? What are sheds all about? So as a person who doesn't even have any hunting background, you could pick it up and basically learn how to shed hunt. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of explanation about, you know, how like strategy, what you do, where you go, what you're kind of looking for. And then mixed in with that is just a bunch of my own personal stories. You know, I've been shed hunting now for 10 plus years. Mm-hmm. And had some fun adventures in that. I've had the opportunity to go and shed hunt in some phenomenal places. So I just kind of was able to add all of those stories and things together and create a book out of it.
Nice. So let's give us one of the, and again, obviously it's not going to be verbatim from the book, but give us one of your favorite stories that you've included in the book.
Yeah. Well, I have to go back and talk about my grandpa because he was hugely inspirational to me. As kids growing up, you know, he always would tell us a little bit about hunting and stories. And so he always had this story where he was hunting antelope, I think, and kneeled on a cactus. And, you know, I always thought that was funny as a kid. And I think he kind of changed the story around to he sat down on a cactus and got all the prickles in his butt. And It was years later when I finally started shed hunting and I came out here and I hadn't really spent a lot of time out here and I did the same thing. I sat down directly on a cactus and then had to spend, you know, 20, 30 minutes poking these cactus prickles out of my butt. Mm-hmm. And I always think about that anytime I'm out and about now and you see a cactus, I'm like, oh yeah, you got to watch for them. And I've done it one too many times after that even. So I make sure I carry tweezers in my pack whenever I'm out here.
So it's kind of like a rite of passage is what you're saying. If you want to find sheds, you got to sit on at least one cactus, maybe more.
Yeah, apparently that's the way to do it is maybe it's a good luck charm is you get it, get a cactus prick somewhere in you.
Nice. So a lot of our strategy for shed hunting will revolve around obviously food and bedding. Where we're at, that changes throughout the season. So where you see the deer early season, their food and bedding is going to change come, you know, December, January, February, when they're starting to drop their sheds. So it's not only that, but it's also finding like the winter cover and the winter food sources and then kind of working your way out from either one of those. Because, you know, that's where they're spending the most time is where you, at least where we're at, a lot of times where you're going to find a decent number of sheds. And if not, you can kind of work your way out from there. Is that similar to what you're doing? And would that be something that you would recommend to people starting out? What would be some baseline advice you would give just starting out when it comes to finding sheds?
Yeah, you kind of hit the nail on the head there. Like I would say that there's kind of three main areas you're looking. So there's like their food, where they're eating, then there's their bedding, and then there's kind of those transition zones, or the areas in between food and bed. That's kind of the bread and butter of finding deer. And absolutely, it does change. You know, there's places where it can be loaded with deer, you know, all hunting season, and then they just kind of go off somewhere else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you see that with a lot of, like, you know, migrations and stuff like that. I don't think we're necessarily as a, you know, in Alberta, I don't think we have, like, the migrations necessarily, you know, cross provincial borders and stuff like that. But they definitely do shift and move around to kind of winter ranges.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of in the book. I laid out a bunch of different strategies, and you're absolutely right. It's very dependent on terrain, right? So the strategy I would use in the mountains would not be the same as, you know, where there's lots of ag fields and food plots and stuff like that.
Right.
So the basic rule that I was always told, and, you know, a lot of people tell me this with fence lines, just go walk a fence line. And I started doing that and didn't have a ton of success.
I never did either.
I don't know where this rumor is getting propagated. This is everyone talks about fence lines, and it is true. Like, I've picked up, you know, a giant elk shed just off of a fence line, and they do get knocked off from, you know, jumping up and over.
Mm-hmm.
But my strategy tends to be, you know, I think about what species am I looking for, and you know, what terrain I'm in, and then kind of going from there. The biggest thing that I find, you know, in Alberta with a lot of the snow cover we have, is you find the south-facing slopes. So there's the snow gets melted off
mm-hmm.
of the south-facing slope, and that's kind of where they tend to hang out, at least, you know, transition-wise. And even, like, when they're feeding, they obviously don't want to dig through a couple feet of snow. They're going to go onto that south-facing slope where everything melts off early.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of the name of the game, I think. And when it comes to those fence rows or a fence crossing or a creek crossing where they do have to jump, sure, they have a decent, I mean, they have a chance of knocking that thing off with the impact of the ground, but you got to think they're there for like a second or 2 seconds, whereas they're spending mm-hmm. hours in their bedding or food, so there's that much more likelihood that that's when that shed's going to be ready to drop.
I'll tell you who told me.
Absolutely.
Who told me to walk fence lines was the guys that were going to go in the bedding areas and pick up the horns, and they didn't want me in there.
Yeah, that's why it's a very popular thing. You know, a lot of people get told go walk on fence lines, and it is, you know, most times the fence lines are clear of brush and stuff like that, so it's easy walking. I know a lot of guys who cruise around on quads and stuff like that. That's kind of what they do, is they go and just, you know, that's the easiest place to go. You're not going to get your quad stuck or anything like that, and you can cover a lot of country doing that way.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I do love, you know, I'm a big hiker and stuff like that. I don't like quadding or anything like that. But, I try and find, if I'm going to go out and go fence lining, it's to find the trail where the deer are crossing and then, you know, stay on that trail mm-hmm. past the fence line.
If you're like most hunters out there, at some point you've dreamed of having a piece of hunting ground to call your own. Maybe you finally decided to make those dreams a reality. If so, you need to talk to our guy, Rodney Hawkins. Rodney is a land specialist with Midwest Farm and Land. If you haven't heard of them, they aren't your average real estate company. While they do deal in traditional residential and commercial real estate, their specialty is recreational and farm ground. With agents like Rodney serving across the state of Illinois, no matter what you're looking for, they can find it. Even if you want to sell what you already have to upgrade, downgrade, reinvest, whatever, they've got you covered. For more information, you can contact Rodney at 618-925-3153, and he'll get you taken care of. On top of what he does for MFL, Rodney also has his own company called RG Outdoors. They currently carry hard and soft-sided blinds, blind chairs, tree stands, and cameras from Radix Hunting, Tacticam trail cameras, Fission e-bikes, and he's adding new stuff all the time. I've personally used all of these products, and I'm beyond happy with every one of them. The Fission e-bike is a game changer, and you will not find a better one for the price. If you're interested in anything RG Outdoors has to offer, you can send them a message to their Facebook page, RG Outdoors, email them at rgoutdoors@yahoo.com, or again, just call Rodney directly at 618-925-3153. Something else I want to get into is, like, the trails and stuff. Do you find a decent number on those trails, and then, like, relative to the food and the bedding? And then when you do find one, What is your like protocol, I guess, for finding the other one? Is it, will you go to like a grid search? Will you take the idea of, okay, he dropped it this direction, so I'm going to go that direction first? Like, what if you find one and you want to try to find the match set, what are you doing after that?
It's tough to match up sheds. Like, I know guys who will, that's kind of their biggest thing, is they love matching things up. And I find that, you know, a lot of times you can find one and you'll, you know, look 20, 30 yards and bam, there's the other one. But usually my kind of protocol is, yeah, I'll stop and just immediately kind of left and right and just see. Usually I'm looking at the trails, being like, okay, like, where does this trail lead? Like, what kind of, you know, getting the deer's head, right? If I was a deer, like, where would I be going? You know, if I'm a buck that just shed his antlers, like, what is he going to, right? But I have found, like, you know, they'll carry one side for even, you know, a couple of days. So that makes it very difficult to match some of them up. I found one, you know, all the way across the entire river valley, you know, so down, you know, a couple hundred yards and then back up another couple hundred yards. So easily 20 or 30 minutes of very hard hiking, and it just happened to be in a little patch of bushes. So they can be very tricky to match them up, that's for sure. Usually, yeah, I just start looking close, you know, and I don't try and go grid searching necessarily, because you're going to end up walking through a lot of stuff where the deer aren't necessarily walking. So it's very dependent. Like, the woods, it gets a little bit better where you can kind of grid search and it makes more sense. But a lot of times where I'm going out, it's just staying on that trail and trying to find, you know, did they walk another 20 yards, shake their head, and it came off.
Yeah, there's a lot of guys that will tell you if you find one, the other one's got to be close. But I've seen kind of the same thing where some of those, I mean, you'll see one-horned deer a lot in January, February, March. Like, they're, some of those will carry them for a long time after dropping that first one. But it's funny you say that. Like, it can be really hard to match them up. I'm looking at a set right now that we have in here. It's the match set from the same year, like 160-inch deer. One of them is very different colored from the other. And obviously, you know why that is. And a lot of people who shed hunt will know why that is. But I went looking for this specific deer's shed on 10 acres. That's all I have to hunt there. I went specifically looking for his shed. I walked all around the property on travel corridors that I knew he used based on trail cameras. And he ended up, I found his right side between two food plots on the property on a main trail that linked the two. And then, of course, I looked all over that trail. I looked all throughout that area. Never found his left side. Nate came back with me in there, I don't know, a week or so later. We walked all over that general area, all over the 10 acres again. Never found anything. This past shed season, we went in. So, like, you know, winter, spring of 24. We went in, me and Dad and another guy, and we walked the whole property again. We picked up maybe one or two small sheds. And then the other guy that was with us, he kind of beat us back to one of the food plots. He was just standing there waiting on us. And he looks over into the brush, kind of in the same direction where I found the other one. And there's tine sticking up under the leaves. And it happened to be the left side of that same deer from the year before, like 40 yards from where I found his right side. And we walked all over that and never did see it. And like, even if they do drop them close, that's how hard it can be to match them up.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I find whitetail sheds can be a little bit more difficult, just the way that they tend to land on the ground. Like, their shape kind of doesn't lend itself to being super obvious. They do just look like, you know, crop stubble or, you know, little sticks and stuff like that. They blend in incredibly well. I find, yeah, like, it's almost a gimme when they kind of shed out in the open, but once you're into the bush, like, it can get very difficult because they just blend in with those sticks and stuff like that.
The most common, so I found a couple other match sets. When I have found those, it's been like right next to a place he was bedding. It looks like he just got up and shook his head and they both happened to fall off. Is that kind of, have you seen that similar to like when you found matched sets? Because that's kind of been, obviously, the majority of the ones that I found have been, it looks like they were bedded down, they got up, shook their head, and they both happened to fall off right there. Just luck of the draw kind of thing.
Yeah, I found, you know, on a transition zone trail where they're just kind of shed, one right after the other, maybe 20 or 30 yards apart. I found them in bedding areas where they, yeah, they, just like you said, stood up, kind of shook their head, and they both came off. You know, I have found a couple fence landing where they jump and then they land and, you know, maybe one falls off and they give a head a shake to get rid of the other one. So matching up sheds is very cool when you can do it. And I think it's kind of an underrated thing because you have to, yeah, you have to kind of get lucky a little bit with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt. It's a lot similar to hunting in general. But what's kind of your favorite shed that you found or something that's unique, whether it be the actual shed itself or the situation you found it in or whatever makes it special for you? What's like your favorite one that you've got? It's probably like picking out your favorite kid for you, but if you can pick one.
Oh, I have a whole pile. I have, you know, piles and piles and piles of sheds, but when I go and organize them, I have kind of two distinct piles of favorite sheds. Absolutely. And, you know, I can, you know, pick them up and tell you the story of all these different sheds that I've found, you know, just because each one is a unique memory. And that's the other thing I like about some of these sheds is, yeah, they all have a story to them. That's for sure. Probably one of my favorite ones and one of my biggest whitetail ones. And I tell the whole story in the book, but I had found it early season shed hunting. So, it, you know, going through a crop field that was still covered in snow, just looking in kind of the windblown areas and stuff like that. And I'd actually walked around a windblown pond edge that, you know, there's a pretty heavy deer trail on, just seeing. And all I saw was just, you know, a couple pines sticking out of the ground. And the shed had been completely frozen into the ground. Like, it obviously had sat there for quite some time. So had no hope of getting it out at that point because it was just solidly in there. So I remember taking a picture and sending it to a buddy and just being like, oh, look what I found. Like, I wonder what this is. And having to come back. And I came back at one point and it was still frozen in the ground, still couldn't get at it. And so it's like, I knew that this shed was there. And so it's kind of that anticipation of being like, okay, like I got to go back and get this shed at some point. And yeah, sure enough, went back and it was one of the whitetail sheds I've ever found. It was just completely buried. You know, I had to bring a shovel and just shovel out around it to get it out of the ground.
That's, I can't say I've ever found one that's been buried.
Well, I guess we have.
Yeah, I'm always wondering how long it was out there, you know, sitting there. Cause it was, you know, not, fortunately not really chewed on or anything like that, but it was just on this little pond edge and, you know, snowmobilers probably went by, you know, I don't know how many times the farmer would have, harvested crops and stuff like that around it before seeing it. So it was pretty cool to see.
I guess I found several that have been worked under, you know, by a farmer. I guess I found several, just a couple little tines sticking out and he'd rolled it over with a disc or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They don't usually like that. I've been given boxes of sheds where farmers have found them with, you know, the baler or whatever they are, you know, find them in the tractor tiler. And a lot of farmers out here, if you kind of sell them on that, saying like, hey, I'm going to go look for antlers in your field, is that okay? A lot of them are more than happy to let you go on there looking for them because they don't want to run them over because it's an expensive fix when they do.
For sure.
Yeah, no doubt. Those tractor tires are not cheap. That's something, too, that we talk a lot about with hunting is like access, and there's a big issue around access here where we're at. For a lot of people, I mean, it can be a problem. But when it comes to shed hunting, do you find much trouble with access up there? And then, like, what's your guys' public land scene up there in Canada?
Yeah, it's a big thing. I talk about a lot of it in the book because I'm a big private land guy, I guess you could say. So I dedicate a fair bit of time to just, you know, going and visiting people and, you know, visiting the farm saying like, hey, you know, I'm a paramedic around here looking to go do some shed hunting. Do you mind if I go? Mm-hmm. I find that for shed hunting, you're usually a little bit more, like people are a little bit more willing to let you go out there because you're not shooting a gun or anything like that. So, people tend to be, you know, good that way. And I find that opens up a door usually for future permission for hunting. So it is definitely a very useful tool that way because they get kind of used to like, oh yeah, he's that guy. He goes on our land. He's whatever, obsessed with sheds. And then you call them up in hunting season and they kind of already know who you are, kind of as long as you've been respectful and stuff like that, it tends to lend itself to they're all of a sudden a lot more willing to let you out there. Our public land, you know, Northern Alberta is full of public access land, crown land is what it's called out here. And same with kind of the western parts of the province is a lot of crown land. You know, we have a great opportunity out here. If you don't want to call anyone in go shed hunting and just go purely public land, there's tons of public land out here between, you know, Ducks Unlimited, Alberta Conservation Association, lease land, crown land. There's lots of it out here, but I would say some of the best hunting is definitely on that private land.
That's similar to here. I mean, just obviously, for the reason of there's not been people coming through it most of the time. But we don't actually have a ton of public land where we're at here in the Midwest, especially Southern Illinois area. We do have some, a decent amount of acreage, but like once you go out west, closer to the Rockies, there's a lot of BLM ground, which is Bureau of Land Management. There's a lot of national forest ground, stuff like that. It's similar to what you're talking about. There's just thousands and thousands, millions of acres out there of public access where guys can go do this kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also was going to ask, too, how often have you found sheds that you're, like, at least fairly confident is the same animal from the year prior? And do you have some where you've got, like, sets over several years? Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Ridge Hunter Outdoors Podcast. If you've made it to this point, hopefully you're enjoying the show. And if you are, go over to our Facebook page and our Instagram. Give us a follow. It's Ridge Hunter Outdoors. We also have a private Facebook group that's Ridge Hunter Nation. You can go over there and answer a couple questions. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast or you watch any of our shows on YouTube or Carbon TV, you get in that group and just use it as your normal hunting group. Share your success, your failures, pictures, whatever you got. And we'll also give you some extra content in there. I'll ask questions on that, maybe do some surveys occasionally. And we'll also give you guys the opportunity to ask questions for any of our guests that we might have coming on, if we have them lined up in time and that's available. You'll find that at Ridge Hunter Nation. That's on Facebook. Our website is ridgehunteroutdoors.com. That's where you're going to see our scent line, Ridge Hunter Scents, our buck tarsal spray, doe tarsal spray, and our calming spray. All of our apparel is available on the website, and our food plot seed, when it is in stock, is available on the website too. If you want any of that stuff, make sure you use our discount code RHOPOD or FULLDRAW, all caps on either of those, no space, and you get 10% off your entire order. We also have our entire catalog of podcasts on the website, and our video series are available on there as well. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or any other audio platform, give us a like, follow, subscribe, whatever it lets you do, and that'll let you guys know when our episodes come out. They're not always as consistent as we want them to be, but we try to shoot for Monday and Friday. Sometimes it gets on a Tuesday or a Saturday maybe for an episode, and that way you'll know when they come out. It also really helps us without costing you anything. If you're listening to this on YouTube, hopefully you're already subscribed to the channel. If you're not, make sure you do that. If you're not listening to this on YouTube and you're not subscribed, make sure you go over there and do that at Ridge Hunter Outdoors, just like everything else. That's where you'll find our Fall Pursuit Show, Spring Strutting, all of our off-season vlogs will be on there, and much more. If you guys see a video or listening to a podcast on there and you're enjoying it, just drop us a comment. Hey, good show. Really enjoyed it. Something simple. Give the video a like. That really, really helps us out. And again, it doesn't take much of your time at all. You can also find Fall Pursuit on Carbon TV, and Spring Strutting will be on there this spring as well. So make sure you go over to Carbon TV. They have a lot of great shows to offer, and ours will be on there also. Thanks for listening, guys. We really appreciate you tuning in when you do. Now let's get back to the episode.
There is one spot I hunt pretty religiously, and I finally 2 years ago started just keeping that as a separate pile of sheds, because I think it'll be interesting to go back and just say, like, okay, like, you know, has the mule deer here, you know, are they all the same? You know, there's some big up and comers in there. Like, it'll be interesting to look back. I definitely have one, and it's unfortunate because I found his dead head this last shed hunting season, but one big buck where I was looking through my, you know, sheds and was like, oh, like, this is, it's all the same deer. So I don't have his match size, but I think I have 2 or 3 years of him, and then his final, like, big deadhead. So it's cool to find that kind of stuff. Absolutely.
Yeah, we see a lot of that here with the private ground stuff. Just a lot of it lends it to the guys that manage their ground that they have for whitetails. You'll be, if you don't kill the deer, if you're not fortunate enough to put your tag on them, or if you don't find his dead head, a lot of times if you have a well-managed ground and you have that winter thermal cover and the food, you can pick up, I mean, there's guys with huge shed collections and they'll have deer from, you know, age 2 all the way up to age 5, 6 even, you know, if they never caught up with them. So that's always interesting to me as well. And obviously way less likely to happen on public ground.
Yeah. It does happen, though. I know quite a few shed hunters who, yeah, they get that, you know, that long history. And I think that's one thing that's kind of trending, I guess, in hunting, is having that history is almost more important than having, you know, the biggest deer or something like that. Like if you've been able to watch these deer kind of mature and then eventually get to the point where you're comfortable pulling the trigger on them, I think that's, you know, that's part of it. And then kind of having those sheds to kind of prove that is also, you know, something that people really enjoy, and kind of, it does connect you a little bit more to the animal when you do hunt it.
Yeah, it adds a chapter to the story for sure. Builds a history with them. It does make it that much better when you do finally catch up with them. Unfortunately, that one that I've got the match set to, not able to catch up with him. He was probably 185-inch deer last year. And then who knows this year? I haven't seen him this year. I don't know if he died last year or if he's just in a different area or whatever, but he would have been probably 6.5 this year. So obviously would have been super cool to kill him without the history, but with it, it just kind of makes it that much better. Let's get back to the book just a little bit here, because we got a little bit more time. I don't want to keep you all night. So if you had to give like your sales pitch for the book, obviously the title is a pretty good one in itself, A Guide to Shed Hunting. And a lot of guys are good. That's going to pique a lot of guys' interest, because I think it's one of those things that it intrigues a lot of people. It's easy enough to do. You don't, a lot of times, especially around here, have to brave a ton of bad weather to do it. And it is cool to find those sheds. So that's going to be intriguing in and of itself. But what would be your sales pitch, if you will, to people for picking up your book? Like, what do you think would be the most interesting parts of it to them, or the reasons they might want to pick it up?
I really like the book. Like I kind of wrote it with two separate groups in mind, I guess. So the one group would be, if you're getting just into shed hunting and have no idea what you're doing, you know, if you're a complete new person to the outdoor hunting world, like what does shed hunting entail and how to be successful at it? So you don't make all the mistakes that I did, where you're wandering around for hours, not finding anything and getting cold. And then kind of the other demographic would be people who are into shed hunting and are just looking to read some cool stories or kind of pick up on, you know, advice or, and, you know, other tips they may not have heard of, or just kind of dreaming, because I've been able to go and hunt, you know, shed hunt in some phenomenal areas like up in Alaska and Nunavut and all sorts of different terrains and stuff like that. So that would be kind of the two different people that it would be for, is the newbies who are looking for advice, and then the seasoned vets who are just looking for some good stories and some dreams.
Nice. So where are some places people can pick up the book? Where can they find you, like social media or anything like that? Go ahead and let everybody know where they can find the book, and you, if you put any content or anything like that out there.
The book is on Amazon. That's the best place to search for it. And so if you just type in Brown Gold Shed Hunting, I think is what it comes up as. If you just, you can type in the full title, however you want to do it. That's probably the best place to pick it up. I'm working on getting it into some retail stores and stuff like that, but that's a whole nother process. So Amazon's the best spot right now. And then, yeah, I haven't opened up my social media. I used to do a whole bunch of, like, you know, running social media for different companies and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And kind of got out of that realm. So I'm going to try and, you know, fire everything back up. People are more than welcome to find me on Facebook. It's just Martin Bros. And same thing on Instagram. You're more than welcome to follow me. I don't share too much there. I love connecting with other hunters and stuff like that. And I'm definitely looking forward to making some more connections and doing a little bit more traveling to shed hunt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. That, I'll tell you too, you probably know this, but especially on Instagram, if you find some awesome sheds and start posting those, you know, pictures and just maybe some reels telling story of them or walking up on them, people love to see that kind of stuff, so that'd be cool. I'm sure you'd be a good follow for the people who are really interested in shed hunting, which seems to be, I think it's growing in popularity all the time, seems like. So, yeah, everybody listening, make sure you go check out the book. I will link it in the description as well, so it's easy enough to find on Amazon. Martin, I appreciate you coming on, taking some time out of your evening. It's nice talking to you. I'm sure we've got way more that we could talk about, so we'll have to get you back on here at some point, maybe after you find some more big sheds this winter and this spring. But we'll definitely do it again sometime.
100%. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. And yeah, if you guys ever want to come out to Alberta and do a little shed hunting trip, just hit me up. I'm happy to take people out. That's kind of one of my passions, is kind of growing the sport and, you know, just meeting new people and making those connections for sure.
Awesome, man. Well, maybe we can do that one of these days and then return the favor and have you down here. I don't have any great shed hunting spots, but I'm sure we could find somewhere to at least go walk around and say we're shed hunting.
Absolutely. That's all you got to do. You never know where they're going to be.
That's right. All right, man. Thanks.